Today's program has been brought to you by Heritage Foods USA, the nation's largest distributor of heritage breed pigs and turkeys. For more information, visit heritagefoodsusa.com.
Hey, what's up? This is Jack Inslee, host of Full Service Radio. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this show, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more. This is part one of a two-part interview with Dan Barber on Chef Story.
Well, hello, and welcome to Chef Story. This is Dorothy Cann Hamilton, and today I am not at Roberta's, and I am not at the International Culinary Center. I am very lucky because I am up at Stone Barns with Dan Barber. So welcome, Dan.
Thank you.
It's nice to... Thanks for having me up at Stone Barns. Normally, we talk about somebody's past and, you know, how they got to be a chef. But I think there's a lot written about you. And if we have some listeners out there who don't know much about you, you can just Google Dan Barber and you're going to find out his past life. But I think there's so many concepts, issues, ideas that you are the center or the heartbeat for, that I'd like to take today's program and sort of go off script and talk about them. And you've just published a book, The Third Plate, and it's really taking on not the food industry per se, but all of us involved in the food industry to look more deeply on how we source and use our foods and how we construct our plates of eating. And I'd like to talk a little bit and start there.
Yeah.
So I'm going to have to ask that...
Come closer.
Oh, I'd love that. here's my issue with the third plate. I think what you're trying to say is we have to be respectful of the earth and therefore have to move protein, meat-centric, fish-centric, middle of the plate, 12 ounces. We have to rethink that because it's not responsible. It's not sustainable for the world. And I agree with that, you know, and looking long-term. But I don't think it's a new notion, because if you look at the countries where they've been challenged with population and with geography, they moved that off the plate centuries ago. I'm talking India, Southeast Asia, Asia, that they don't eat. They eat minimal ounces of protein. So why are people looking at the third plate and saying it's revolutionary?
Okay. So I think you're right. It's not and I don't claim that this idea of getting away from protein-centric plates of food is a revolutionary new approach to eating. I'm suggesting that, in fact, it is a very old way of eating, as you mentioned, and what I talk about in the book in terms of my research is that it's the basis. The third plate is really the basis of all great cuisines, of any cuisine. A cuisine, by definition, is great because it's lasted thousands of years. And so when you look at how those cuisines evolved, French cuisine, we have an understanding, an American understanding of French cuisine. Really, French cuisine, as you know, is dozens, hundreds, actually, of micro cuisines, just as Italian cuisine is, and Chinese, just Southern Chinese cuisine alone is thousands of iterations based on micro regions and micro ecologies. All of these cuisines evolved out of a negotiation that the peasants were making with the landscape. You know, what could the landscape provide, and how could they make it nutritious and delicious in terms of a diet. That's the genesis of every cuisine.
So it's not built out of responsibility.
No.
Or sensitivity.
No.
It's always built out of
what the land can provide.
And the more luxurious, the better.
The more luxurious, the better. But it was, as all cuisines tell us, true cuisines, which is really the heart. I mean, there's a distinction between the Americanization of Chinese, of Cantonese food, or Szechuanese food, or Japanese food, or Southern French food, or Northern Italian food. Those we have interpretations of them in America based on a very abundant landscape. But the true, if you look at it from the, as in you go to the villages from which they're famous for their suite of dishes that represent their cooking, they're all based on, none of them have protein-centric plates of food because the land could never support that. That was an anomaly. It is an anomaly because it's an American anomaly. We're a very young country, and we have this freakish soil fertility, and we have this environment in many parts of this country that produce incredible abundance. It is the underpinning of what we call the breadbasket to the world, and we have fashioned a expectation for a plate of food. I wouldn't call it a cuisine because I don't. My part of my search in this book is what is American cuisine, and I never really came to a good definition of it because there isn't one. I mean, it's
regional cuisine.
There are regional. The only regional cuisine that I could really look at, and again, I'm defining cuisine in a very narrow sense. I'm combining it as a pattern of eating that supports what the landscape can provide.
Right.
Okay. So I look at Southern cooking as like a very good example of that. The Carolina Rice Kitchen, Creole cooking, I mean, all of those evolved really out of hardship. The Carolina Rice Kitchen came out of a soil crisis in the 1820s, which is when farmers dropped their plows and they started moving out west. They plowed up the prairie. And the ones who were left behind were struggling to figure out, you know, how do we produce food in soil that is failing and failing rapidly? And this is when the government opened up the Midwest and encouraged farmers to come out and settle the Midwest and to farm for free. The ones who were left behind is a very interesting story of how Southern cuisine came to be. But at its root, it came out of desperation. And it was, how do you get the rice, for example, which was such a big part of Southern, not only culture, but economy. We were the largest grower of rice in the world. We were exporting it to every country in the world. And
what years in the 19th century?
The early 1800s.
Yeah.
Through the 1810s, and then things really started to decline very rapidly. And so the question was, how do you produce really rice and other crops for which, you know, Southerners were both enjoying and exporting? How do you get the fertility back? And that began this period of experimentation for 20 and 30 and 40 years, where I read historical documents of hundreds of varieties of rutabaga were planted to figure out, well, what grew really well in that, and what provided the right kind of fertility and broke up disease cycles and repelled pests and all of this. You know, massive scale of experimentation.
Slaves,
and slaves were bringing
and
over.
Slave owners.
And plantation owners were encouraging it and allowing it because they too were seeing the drops in fertility that had never been seen before. And so slaves were taking what they had new from North Africa.
I see.
And they were implementing rotations for the first time. That's where you get dishes like Hop and John. I mean, Hop and John is not a dish of rice. It's a dish of rice and beans. You needed the beans to get the leguminous crop to give you the nitrogen in the soil that allowed you to have the rice. And you needed collard greens because collard greens desalinated the soil. And the soil was salty and filled and degrading the soil. And collard greens, as Africans knew, desalinated the soil. So you had that as part of the dish, and then you had this sort of smattering of pork. It wasn't any kind of center cut piece of pork. It was cut up, cured pieces of fat. And while the pigs were running free in the lush forests of east of the Mississippi when it rained, you know, lots of rainfall, and you had these very fat pigs, which became a big part of Southern cuisine. But anyway, encapsulated in that one dish, nitrogen-fixing leguminous crop, delicious and healthful plate of rice along with collard greens, you had a nutritious and delicious plate, iconic southern
dish. So it's like India or China.
It's like any of the cuisines. That's why I call it cuisine. So when you say regional cuisines, you know, I got in a lot of trouble a couple of weeks ago. I was out in California, and someone in the audience, I was in LA, and someone said, you know, the California cuisine. And I said, what is that? I don't know what that is. What is California cuisine? I don't know.
You
know,
Michael McCarty and Jonathan Waxman.
Yeah,
know,
those
are, and Alice
and those, Waters. And those are great, yeah, all yeah. great chefs, but yeah. they are celebrating
Provence.
Products.
No, well, they were all influenced by Europe and freshness and seasonality.
Yes, and
local.
And that table movement. And that's because you are cherry picking great products. Supports a landscape. You are celebrating the abundance of really soil fertility. So you can point to great tomatoes. You can point to great eggplant and great zucchini. All the things that I got at the farmer's market this morning, or corn or wheat on the grain level. And that is what America has produced over the last 250 years in great abundance because of soil fertility, because environmental conditions allow us to eat high on the hog. My argument of the third plate is that those crops, while you can get them from a local farmer and celebrate their regionality and their distinctiveness and their deliciousness, they are, from a soil perspective, very greedy. A tomato is the equivalent of eating a rack of pork, a loin of pork. It's eating high on the hog because it requires a lot of real estate, it requires a lot of time, and it requires a ton
water.
Of soil fertility and a ton of... It's a resource sucker. It's the Hummer of the vegetable world. That's what it is. But what we... It's not to say that I don't...
Called it the Hummer of the vegetable world?
I think I think probably I've called some other things the Hummers. We forget that wheat is the Hummer of the grain world. Corn, we all know corn is a huge environmental resource-intensive crop. So is wheat. So are tomatoes. So are zucchini. So are eggplant. And so to call oneself, as I have called myself, I would point all the vectors at me because I was this guy. I was the guy who was saying, you know, farm to table is the way to opt out of the industrial food system, the way we're eating, which is not only bad for us, but bad for the environment and totally unsustainable. We've got to connect with farmers. We've got to celebrate these grain ingredients.
Right.
There's nothing wrong with that, per se. What was wrong with it, which is what I was saying going a step further and saying, this is the way to look at the future of eating. And it's not, because the land will not support that in a growing population or any kind of population over the long haul. If we don't think about eating, if we don't think about our diets from the entire farm perspective, the entire farm perspective says, ask the question, what are the crops that are going in before your tomatoes are planted that's giving you the fertility that allows you to have those tomatoes?
And not raping the soil.
And not depleting the soil. We've got to think of the soil as a bank account. That's the best analogy that I was told to me. It's not my idea. It was told to me from a farmer that I became sort of the hero of this book, Klaus Martens. And he had made this beautiful analogy. Every time we eat, we're eating from a withdrawal from the bank account. And the bank account is soil, and you have to pay back the bank account. And when you eat a tomato, you're making a very large withdrawal from your bank account. When you eat wheat, you're making a very large withdrawal. Corn is a huge withdrawal. So what you need to do is either put back nutrients through compost, which on a market garden or a vegetable garden in your backyard is a very smart and efficient way. But in a bigger farm scenario, community farms, larger farms, mid-sized farms, you don't go and compost 1,000 acres. So you have to figure out a way. You know, you can graze animals and they drop their manure, and that's one way to restore fertility soil. But another way to restore fertility soil, and the way that all cuisines evolved restoring fertility soil, is by rotating in crops that don't require a lot of soil fertility but actually add fertility. These are crops in the grain world like barley, buckwheat, millet, leguminous crops like nitrogen-fixing leguminous crops like beans, and cover crops like vetch and clover. This is the whole suite of rotations that farmers need to get the fertility for the crops
right.
that we cut.
So are you saying...
So my point is we need to eat that whole thing.
Right. So are you saying that to be a responsible steward of the earth, you should only be eating crops that can renew the soil, that are working towards the seasonality and the location, and therefore it's almost immoral to eat a tomato?
No, I'm saying because I just ate a tomato for dinner, so I had to play.
Well,
the
you might be immoral.
Dinner.
I mean,
right? True, true. No, I think there's nothing wrong with celebrating tomatoes, just as there's nothing wrong with celebrating a good steak.
But wait. If you're drought challenged, like California,
right?
And how much water does it take to produce
a lot? So, but my point is, if you're eating in the context of a cuisine. And remember, again, my definition of cuisine is what does the land tell you it can provide? And then...
California's telling you can't provide tomatoes.
Well, but it's telling you these last few years. But, you know, overall, California is also a good place to grow tomatoes if you have abundant, water from the Sierras. I'm not saying you need to export those tomatoes all over the world. I'm saying if you live in California and you're enjoying a tomato, I don't think there's anything wrong with that. What I think's wrong with it is if you eat tomatoes or you eat corn or you eat wheat with such excess in your diet and call yourself a sustainable eater because you're connected to a local farmer. My point is that if you're eating in the context of true sustainability, you're eating with a lot of diversity. And within that diversity, you're eating...
Wait, I'm not letting you off the
tomato. No, I don't want you to keep going on the tomato.
Okay.
Yeah.
Last 2 years, worst drought in the history of California.
Right.
California
is exporting 80%, 85% of the food they produce. 85% of the fertility of the soil is going into the rest of the country and throughout the world. That's not a very good sustainable system for the future.
So what do people in New Mexico do?
What
do they grow? What do people in the
what they've always grown? Beans. And drought tolerant beans like temporary, which are
they should not take any tomatoes from California.
No, because when there's rainfall and irrigation in Mexico, they should be celebrating the tomato because they've eaten basically a diet of beans and other crops that give you the necessary requisite fertility to enjoy a tomato. It's all about balance. It's not about black and white.
So you're saying if you're a resident of California, you can eat a tomato happily and responsibly.
Of course.
But if you eat that tomato in New York City, you're really squandering Californian fertility.
You're squandering. You're drinking water.
But the Californians are the ones that are making money off of it.
You're essentially shipping water across the country. Is what you're doing.
And they don't
water.
Because
tomato is 90% water.
Water.
So you're shipping water across the country. That makes no sense.
But is there enough water to produce enough tomatoes for the population of California? Is this something we have to look? Sure, there is.
Oh my God! I mean, the tomato is nothing. If you're talking about grain-fed beef, which is where
I'm not saying
80% of the water goes. So it's not the tomato that's sucking all that water. It's the beef and it's the corn that's growing in California to feed the beef cattle. That's where the water's going. The dairy industry is where all the water goes. It's not the specialty crop tomato. Let's put it this way. If you're really talking on that scale, grains, which is essentially corn, wheat, soy, those are the top ones, represent... right now, as of today, 68% to almost 70% of our agriculture. 70% of our agricultural land is in those three grains. There's a lot of other grains in there, but the predominant ones are those three. Cotton is a big one. But those three represent almost 70% of our agricultural land. Vegetables are 5%. Your tomato is less than 1%.
So it's nothing.
It's more to look at it because we love tomatoes. And I used to talk about tomatoes, a local heirloom tomato from, you know, the Hudson Valley as the answer to, you know, the malicious and destructive industrial food chain. It's just you've got to look at this. You know, there's a great expression in the farm table movement that's called nose to tail eating, right? You eat the whole animal and you don't expect to eat high on the hog, right? Well, but we should be thinking about that for the whole farm. We should be thinking nose to tail of the entire farm.
Well, you're doing field to table now.
Field to table, but you have to think about the entire field. Not just the crops that we cover.
The cover crops.
The cover crops, the in-between crops, the crops that break up disease cycles, all the crops that farmers grow, but they consider them sunk costs because they know they don't have a market for it. So this is
the easy solution, because if you can make those crops delicious.
That's why I point the finger to chefs and I say, you know, for the immediate future in America, since we don't really have a cuisine to fall back on. You know, I feel jealous of people like Rene Redzepi. Well, I feel jealous of Rene Redzepi for a lot of reasons. He's a fantastic chef. He's a phenomenal person. But one of the things that I think about a lot is that chefs like Rene Redzepi, or Massimo Bottura in Italy, or Alex Atala in San Paolo, I'm going sort of throughout the world, or Sean Brock in the South, is in Charleston. You know, these chefs, these phenomenal chefs, have yet another advantage over most chefs in America, which is that we don't have a cuisine to fall back on. So part of their extraordinary gastronomical accomplishments has been that they are tethered to a tradition, to a cuisine. They're riffing on it, they're modernizing it, they're changing it, they're updating it, thinking about it for the future. But there's something that culturally you can take hold of and run with. You can't do that here, where we're sitting right now in the Hudson Valley, because if you look at the history of the Hudson Valley, there's no such thing as a cuisine. There's an abundance of agriculture products, but there's no pattern of eating that puts it together that prevents us, me and you and most everyone else, from indulging in a...
I'm trying to think of France and Italy and Rene Redzepi, falling back on their cuisine.
I didn't say falling back. What I say is like reaching back and looking in very soft ways. I mean, what Rene Redzepi? I mean, what is Viking cuisine? You know, I don't know. It's like herring. It's like there's not a lot there. But what he's done is brilliantly extrapolate that history, that culture, that sense of place, and create and launched it into the modern era of the chef to do that. I'm saying I'm hobbled a bit. It's funny to say I'm hobbled as I'm sitting amidst, you know, the bounty. We're sitting ground zero of some of the best. This has been one of the best summers for fertility for harvest, and we're sitting in the middle of August. So it's really about harvest time of everything. And yet I'm saying I'm hobbled because we don't have a framework in our country, in America, to reach back that gives us a prescription, a pattern, a expectation for eating that really responds to what the landscape has.
Wait, I'm gonna challenge you on that. You know, I'm from Nova Scotia, or my family. I was born in New York. Chowder just perfectly uses the fish from the sea, salt pork, and potatoes. Fantastic potatoes in the Maritimes.
A fish chowder is a great example of a third plate item. I didn't say I invented it. I said that's a good example of where we need to go throughout our entire menu, because a chowder is like a bouillabaisse.
It uses
trashier fish. It uses fish that you can break up. It uses the whole thing, and you create this delicious, iconic dish. Well, that's what we need to do with our whole menu.
And you know, when I was growing up in New York, in Brooklyn, we had fig trees. We had a garden with lettuce. And you know what? We ate a lot of bluefish. My father used to go fishing off of Sheepshead Bay. And potatoes from Long Island. And potatoes took very well to our... Now, did we probably bring the potatoes over from Europe?
There's nothing wrong with that.
And I'm thinking of the farms I would go to in upstate New York. And there were chickens on the farm, eggs on the farm, potatoes. And I think that is the European cuisines that came over here and found their...
It's not European cuisines that came over here. I disagree with that. It's European methods of growing. And it's European traditions around celebratory foods in large part. This is not black and white. There are many examples. Bluefish is...
Chicken pot pie
is a third plate. Casserole in many ways. A hot dog and a hamburger are third plates in many ways. If you're raising the right beef and raising the right pigs, you've got a third plate there. You've got excess trimmings that are put together to make something delicious. In a bun.
So isn't that... I think chicken pot pie is, you know, a New York steak is that you came to New York and you went to a steakhouse. And it was those cowboys that were eating 12 ounces.
Well, not the cowboys. Not the cowboys. Breakfast. If you look at this, we've been eating... All Americans have been eating the steak twice a day, 7 days a week, as an expectation for dinner since going back to the beginning of this country. I always thought that we should be hearkening back to a time when we ate sustainably and deliciously. And the truth is, and farmed sustainably. The truth is, there is no history of that in this country. We are a history of really bad farming, actually. Going back to the beginning, which is the people who came over here in the first place didn't own land. They didn't know how to farm. That's the truth of that. And I don't, you know, I spent a lot of time in the books sort of
because they were merchants adventurers.
Yeah. And what they got when they got over here was incredible soil and rainfall and weather conditions that were conducive to growing a lot of great food. The South is a perfect example of that. Until there was no more fertility. And that's the 1820s. And you had this period of extraordinary excess food where you got people's diaries over here who said, I've never come to a place. It's like the Garden of Eden. The food, this is late 1700s. People are talking, but you come over here and you have excess and people saying it's disgusting what Americans throw away and eat. That was all based in abundance. That was not brilliant farming techniques.
Back then, we were Europeans who'd come over here.
Yeah.
Why didn't the Europeans do that in Europe?
Because first of all, remember, they're many, many thousands of years older, right?
Right.
And Europe, let's take Italy, fits inside California. So we are an enormous country. That's another thing I learned in the book, which is sort of obvious. But it's really not. When you look at it from a geographic scale, we have enormous ecologies of great variances. So we have many Europes inside the United States. But going back to the Europe example, why didn't they do that? Because they couldn't afford it. They came over here and did it here and moved across the country.
So
doing
it wasn't just
that's virgin
America.
Soil. Yes. That's virgin soil.
So isn't that just sort of in the DNA?
That's in the DNA. That's why you have cuisine, because cuisines prevent you from your worst gluttony. They don't allow you to eat a 7-ounce steak twice a day, 7 days a week. They allow you to celebrate a 7-ounce steak, which is the same way they allow you to celebrate a tomato. But they don't say to you, you, as a citizen of the world, you are allowed to be gluttonous for just the foods that you want to eat. You are not allowed to dictate your diet and tell the land what it needs to produce. It's the other way around. So whether it's a paleo diet or a steak and eggs dinner or whatever it is, we are presuming that we can tell the land what we want for our diets, and it will, that's an American presumption. Europe never had that luxury. Europe's cooking and traditions are based on eking out what the land can provide, just trying to figure out what it could provide, and then making that delicious and nutritious, and in many ways last long enough to go through the winter. I mean, that's the story of cuisine. And we have great cuisines, great traditions out of all of them. That's where we should look as Americans. And I think you're right. And you're the only one in all of these interviews I've had who's pointed to the chef. Well, of course you would. And I'll put it together. But you point to the chef, I think, is a good place to point, because this is a heavy load for the American home cook to lift. And I think chefs can and are increasingly putting these pieces together in a way. You know, we don't go to a restaurant now, a fine dining restaurant, and if you go downstairs and have dinner tonight, which I hope you will, you're not going to eat lobster, caviar, and foie gras. Now, 20 years ago, you and I both know that was the expectation. If you didn't have something like that throughout your fine dining experience, you weren't in a fine dining restaurant. We forget that chefs have turned this notion of fine dining on its head. Rene Redzepi is a good example of it. It was happening before him, too. It wasn't being led by me. I'm reporting on what chefs are doing. And I think more and more chefs are looking in hyper local and regional and looking at, well, what is the traditions? What are the land telling them that it can grow? And how can they make even the lowliest cut of meat or the lowliest vegetable like kale or the lowliest this and make it delicious and stunning and make it a part of their cuisine? That's the future of great cooking. And that is the third plate. It's not my invention. I'm, again, reporting on what's starting to happen more and more. And I think that's a cultural shift. That people are, that's going to bleed into the culture. Okay. Just as the Cheesecake Factory, you know, or Chipotle is an example of that being bled into the culture. That Chipotle's success, in part, is an example of chefs leading the way with great products. And they have now brilliantly, I think, democratized those ideas into a fast food chain. That's where this ends up working in later in our generation or the next generation. I don't know. I don't have a time frame on this. But ultimately, I think we're talking about a much more delicious future that's much more resilient and responsive to what the land is telling us can grow, because we have no other choice increasingly. That would be my summation.
Okay. So we're going to take a break here. We'll be right back.
This has been part one of a two-part interview with Dan Barber on Chef Story. Tune in next week for part two.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.